Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On December 13, 1934, Albert Fish was apprehended by Detective William King for the kidnapping and murder of 10-year-old Grace Budd. Fish's defense attorney obtained the services of Dr. Frederick Wertham for Fish's psychiatric examination. Dr. Wertham's files were ordered closed until 2010. Documents from Wertham's files, including confessions and writings by Albert Fish, are published here for the very first time in history. Fully illustrated, including confessions and other writings, includes never-before-seen documents handwritten by Albert Fish. Fish's own story of weird life, written by Albert Fish for the New York Daily Mirror newspaper. From the files of Dr. Wertham, Fish's psychiatric examination and Rorschach test results. Masks Have No Ears, from Dr. Frederick Wertham's book, The Show of Violence. Also includes court documents, correspondence, Grace Budd and Billy Gaffney confessions, newspaper excerpts, photographs, and Fish's vile letters. The book that we're featuring this evening is Albert Fish in His Own Words, with my special guest, filmmaker and author, John Barofsky. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, John Barofsky.
Hi, thanks for having me on, and I think Fish's case is definitely the most shocking. I mean, obviously, these, you know, serial killers are all pretty brutal, but to me personally, Fish is the most depraved, deranged, and, just pretty much the one that would give me nightmares.
Sure. Well, we're going to find that out in the next hour, all about that, from your fascinating book, Albert Fish in His Own Words. Now, just as in the introduction, we talked about that Dr. Wertham's files were ordered closed until 2010. So since 1935 till 2010, incredible amount of time. Tell us how you became in a position to know about this and why, again, you just alluded to why you would want to write this book, but tell us how you became in a position to write this book and how you knew about the files being released in 2010. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, my film on Albert Fish was released, I believe, around 2007. And, you know, I had always been fascinated with the case. It was a follow-up to my first film on H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. And once again, after I had made Holmes, you know, no one had made a film on H.H. Holmes. And I was thinking of my second topic, and I heard about Albert Fish, of course, and thought, once again, why didn't anyone make a film of this guy? I mean, it's fascinating. These early true crime stories are extremely fascinating, and that's why when I create my documentary feature films, they're focusing on pre-1940s serial killers, usually, because of the lack of forensics, how long they may have gotten away with these crimes. So after I finished the film, which there was research available while I was making the film, there were books on Fish and other information. And then, of course, for my film, I had interviewed experts and filmed some location footage of whatever's left since Fish's time period. And I had found out online that I had done researching, of course, with Dr. Wertham's files, and I had found out online that there were a portion of his files regarding Albert Fish that were sealed until 2010. So once 2010 rolled around, of course, I wanted to know what was, you know, in these sealed files. And there was a wealth of information. Everything, as you stated in the opening, from Fish's Rorschach test, where Interestingly enough, but not surprising, everything he basically saw in the ink blots was, you know, an ass or a penis or things that he was fascinated by, you know, being into S&M and, you know, cannibalizing these young children in 1920s New York City. But there were also many other writings. There were confessions that Fish wrote in his own handwriting that I had never read before, and they had never been published. They were a little difficult to read because his handwriting was not easy to read, so I hired a transcriptionist to transcribe all of his letters. So throughout the book, there will be a letter from Albert Fish in the transcription, making it easy for readers to read. But when I publish my books on true crime, I do like to release the original files from my research, because many authors write books, you know, on serial killers, and they give their own opinion. Some of them even say they're factual and they're true crime books. But some of these books, I've found things that were created, which, you know, through my research, I could never find where they found these items that they added to the books. So there, I found out that their true crime books weren't 100% true. So that's why, again, when you're looking at original case files, you know, I don't think you get, you know, more truth than that. Sure, sometimes, you know, the confessions may be lies, but, you know, I really don't put many newspaper excerpts in my books because, once again, you know, the further back you go, the newspapers are kind of like the National Enquirer, and you really can't put too much research emphasis, you know, on those. They were sensational, you know. So, and I figured, you know, get these scans of, you know, all of these documents and put this book together, so other researchers, you know, could have all this material basically in one book without having to go to the Library of Congress or go to all these historical societies. You know, for between $20 and $30, you've got all this information in a book. And, you know, some people may say, well, it's just the true crime case files. But once again, you know, you can't find any other book that has these materials in there. You'd have to do research, request materials, pay for copies. You know, and that's pretty expensive. Like my first book on H.H. Holmes, The Strange Case of Dr. H.H. Holmes, you know, I had many of those books, you know, scanned, and, you know, I paid hundreds of dollars, you know, to have all that information. And you know, you can't find, especially like H.H. Holmes, some of those books were from, you know, the late 1800s. It's pretty much impossible to actually find a copy of those. And through my diligent research, like for Holmes, I had found one of the actual original Holmes Peitzel case books, and then Holmes's own story. There are only two copies in the world that are still in existence, one at the Library of Congress and one at a Toronto library. So, you know, again, the whole idea is to share my research, you know, after, you know, I've made films on these serial killers. The last biography I did of a serial killer was Carl Panzram, and that's going to be my next book, but it's going to focus on his time at Leavenworth. Because interestingly enough, when you read the only book that's available, one only book that's available on Carl Panzram, which was written by Thomas Gaddis, who also wrote The Birdman of Alcatraz, and then Jim Long, when you read that book, the whole second half of the book was based on Robert Stroud's writings on Carl Panzram, because Robert Stroud, he wasn't the Birdman of Alcatraz. He was the Birdman of Leavenworth. He had the birds at Leavenworth. So already, that's not a true crime book, you know? And luckily for the Birdman of Alcatraz, Tom Gaddis was smart enough to put in the front of the book that some things were fictionalized. So Robert Stroud was right across the cell directly. He had two cells for all his birds, but he was directly across the cell from Carl Panzram. So he observed everything, and he wrote everything. The writers of the book Killer of Journal of Murder, they did not have access to the federal files, which I had access to. So once again, there are reasons why I want to publish a book on Panzram at Leavenworth, which really won't conflict with their book, because their book has all of Panzram's writings in it, but I want to fill in a lot of that information of what happened at Leavenworth, you know, the first federal penitentiary. And he was the first prisoner executed at a federal penitentiary. So, you know, again, we could go on for hours on all these issues, but there are, you know, I'll let you bring it back to the topic.
Let's get to what you did find. And I mean, there is some information that I have read before, but let's talk about the information that is exclusive. And let's get back to, for those people that don't know about this Albert Fish's troubled life, take us back to, he was born in 1870 in Washington, but you talk about 1875, his life becomes very, very interesting. And tell us about his father's death and the orphanage and the effect, what he did see and experience in that orphanage.
Yeah, you know, the orphanage for Albert Fish was, you know, kind of like the genesis for the direction for the rest of his life. And I've seen this as I've studied serial killers. I'm not a PhD expert. I'm a filmmaker. I did go to film school, but I've researched serial killers, and I've also interviewed numerous forensic psychologists and experts on serial killers. So I do consider myself an expert on, you know, serial killers, and especially their history and the time they grew up in. And, you know, personally, my belief is, you know, these serial killers are mainly created by their environment. You know, there's all these different beliefs of, it could be genetic, it could be brain damage, it could be a head injury, you know, there are triggers, it could be abuse. But, you know, the formative years, especially between 7 and 12, when many of these children see or experience things, that could be traumatic. It doesn't necessarily have to be an abuse. But with Fish, it was twofold. So when he was in this orphanage, what they would do is to punish the children, they would strip the children naked, usually the male children. They would strip them naked and whip them on their bare behinds and force other children to watch this abuse going down. So through that, Fish developed his S&M fantasies, and he even said it himself that at 7 years old, he had his first sex feeling because he was turned on by that. He was turned on by watching these kids abused and whipped, and he was turned on when it was, you know, given to him as well. So, you know, you look at the rest of his entire life, it's no wonder that he's writing women and all these other people desiring for asking them to whip him, and maybe he could do the same to them, and going as extreme as possible. So, you know, and talking about Carl Panzram in a sense, just to not go too far off topic, but you know, he was in a reform school, and the same thing kind of happened to him. You know, there, I found a punishment slip from Red Wing Reform School where he was at, and on that punishment slip, it said that he attempted to escape, and the punishment was has a spanking. Well, that was his whole life. Over and over again, he would break out of prisons. He broke into a prison to rescue another prisoner. He got in, but he was caught. He actually broke into a prison. You know, he would break out of these prisons, and he, you know, would be whipped and abused and tortured and electrocuted. And it's the same kind of thing. Panzram's whole life is on that one punishment slip. And that was the same thing with Albert Fish. So we see that how trauma and abuse could affect some of these children and maybe not affect others. There, you know, I'm sure there are many children we know for a fact, you know, Carl Panzram had a brother that turned out to be a police officer. You know, some children don't, you know, go to these extremes, but some have that fragile mentality. And Albert Fish was one
Excuse
of
me.
Them. So
the thing is, what we've passed over is that, and again, this must have some psychological effect, but we didn't talk about his father dying at 5 years old. And then the reason why he's even in an orphanage in the first place seems odd to us looking at this now. Why was he put in the orphanage if his mother was working? So why he was not actually an orphan. So tell us the circumstances and tell us how long he was in here before he was, again, reunited with his family. We talk about some of the things he learned in there, but the very first circumstances, how he got to the orphanage in the first place.
Yeah, some of his early, you know, childhood is unclear to me. You know, I've researched his entire life, but maybe you could fill in some of that, because I do remember he was sent to an orphanage and there were some issues with his family, and his family also had a religious, you know, psychosis that he actually had as well. So there may be some of this genetic influence on him as well.
Well, you talk about that there's seven relatives that, and I don't know who made this assessment. And I find it fascinating that this long ago that they were making the psychopathic personality diagnosis. I'm very, very surprised by that. But they said that you say in the book that there were seven relatives, including Fish, that either had some noted
yes.
mental illness or psychosis or psychopathic personality. You talk about that his father died at five years old. His mother was working but still felt the need to put him in the orphanage. And you say he learned many of the deviations and paraphilias that he was afflicted by, we'll say, for lack of a better term, were rooted mm-hmm. in his stay at this institution here. When did he, yeah. as you write in the book, when did he get out and what was his behavior like after this?
Well, you know, the writings in the book are actually like they're from Dr. Wortham. You know, the only thing I may have written was the foreword, you know. So, you know, I know eventually he was released and, you know, he did marry and had children and grandchildren. So, you know, there was a period of time where he was obviously on his own. And even when he was with his wife, he had felt restricted where he was, you know, felt he wasn't able to do ultimately all the things that, you know, he truly wanted to do. And we'll get to that point later as well. But, you know, eventually he did marry and supposedly, you know, his family said he never, you know, harmed them or spoke, you know, a bad word to them. He never swore, never raised a hand to them. And, you know, that also fits in with this duality of serial killers where they can have a family and fool them at the same time they're doing these other devious acts.
Previous, though, to him being married, that there was a – he does get a run-in with the law before that, and you talk about actually being examined a couple times at hospital, so
yeah.
we'll have to go into
yeah.
when that is. He develops a job, though. He has a trade that enables him, and I guess enabled him to be able to do some
mm-hmm.
of this some of the murderous stuff he does and the violence that he does. What's that occupation that he – eventually, even for a lifetime, develops this occupation that he undertakes?
Yeah, he was a house painter. So, you know, he was always traveling, always on the go. And additionally, he always had these empty spaces available to him to potentially bring his victims to do whatever he wanted. So there, you know, much of this fits in with the MO of a serial killer. Traveling, he traveled all across the U.S. You know, he had these places of opportunity and victims of opportunity. Many times at that time period, he said he would target, you know, young African American male children because no one cared about them, which is a sad truth.
Okay. You say too that that all along the way he developed the paraphilia of sadism and masochism, but also that he wanted to inflict pain as he enjoyed hearing other people's pain, but he also enjoyed pain himself. To that end, we'll talk about the needles, but what did he first begin with simply in terms of inflicting pain on himself? And was there any, we talked about his religiosity and the
yes.
families, was there some connection there with that religiosity?
Yeah, there was a connection. You know, it was known that, you know, one or more members of his family had that same type of extreme religious dementia, you know, and that may have been passed on to Albert Fish, where, you know, as the years went by, you know, he took the Bible literally, you know, and he associated the, you know, a communion with drinking the blood of Jesus and, you know, tasting the body with the wafers, you know, and he enacted that in real life, you know, in a sense, he thought that he was doing good by murdering these children before they were violated or raped by someone else and sending them straight to heaven. You know, he also associated very strongly with the story of Abraham and Isaac, where Abraham would kill his own child. You know, and he had part of the religious dementia. He said he would hear voices, you know, reading quotes from the Bible, you would see Jesus and, you know, have these visions where he would see things like, you know, dasheth their heads against the stone. And, you know, he would take Bible verses and put them in different orders, kind of, in a way to create this pattern of, you know, almost, you know, creating what he really wanted to do. So it was, you know, and was he blaming it? We don't know. But I think it's, you know, there, if you look at his case and all his actions, and especially his writings, especially the Grace Budd letter, when at the end, you know, the last line, what now, you know, he obviously, you know, kidnaps the girl, which, you know, he says he didn't because they let him take her, but, you know, he murders her, cannibalizes her, but he makes sure that the last line of his letter that he wrote to her mother says, I did not fuck her, which is very important, because that's okay that he didn't do that, but what about murdering and cannibalizing her? You know, that's fine, you know. And again, that goes in with, you know, the whole sex before marriage and possibly saving this child before she was violated by somebody else. And in his mind, it got completely twisted. And that is one of the most extreme things about Albert Fish that, again, differentiates him from other serial killers. He committed all sorts of tortures on his body as penance for killing these children. You know, much like the flagellants in the days of old, who would whip themselves on their backs until they were bloody to absolve their sins, he did the same thing, but he took it to huge extremes. You know, his son one time saw him beating himself bloody with a paddle that Albert Fish created himself, where he took this paddle and hammered all these nails into the end of it, and he would beat himself with that bloody. And that's nothing compared to the other things that he would do. Because, you know, with S&M, you know, pain is only relative, so they have to keep up in the ante until it's even more extreme. Some of the most extreme things that he did was, according to Albert Fish himself, he would take a rose, not the head of the rose, but, you know, the base of the rose. Yeah, with the thorns on it. And he said he would insert those into his penis with the thorns on those. And then he said he would also take a alcohol-soaked piece of gauze, insert it in his anus and light it. He'd stick needles under his fingernails. Eventually, when he was apprehended, he told the authorities what he would do to himself as penance for killing these children. Well, they didn't believe him. So they took him to the hospital and took an x-ray of his abdomen, and 29 needles showed up on the x-ray. So in his abdomen, he was living, you know, as a medical marvel. He didn't die, and nothing happened to his internal organs. But when you look at that x-ray, some of these needles are a couple inches or longer. I mean, you can see the eyes of the needles. It's just, you know, so again, this man not only, you know, loved to hear the tortures and cries of children, that's what he got off on. You know, I don't believe he, you know, raped every child. Some of these children, he even said himself that, you know, he just wanted to torture them and hear their cries and screams. You know, and, you know, you see that with other serial killers. They want to get a reaction from their victim. But that's what's most extreme about Albert Fish is, you know, in addition to being a cannibal and a serial killer, he was also, you know, into this masochism where he, you know, couldn't have enough pain inflicted on himself.
Let's talk about the marriage. He has, and it seems like you could say even at the trial, and again, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but his daughters even testify. One of his daughters testifies that he was a great father. He was a good family man. They saw none of this violence. There was none directed towards them whatsoever. And so what we need to know is there is a major incident in here, not to say this is resultant in all the rest of this horror that he inflicts on society and everyone and the victims, but what happens in his marriage? He's married to this woman. They have six children. They're struggling. But one day he sees the dog and suspicious about the dog, and maybe, and then there's an attic in the home. So tell us what this inquisitive Albert Fish does, and the dog, and his family life with the six children. We're talking some small young children, and his wife of many years, 10 years or so. What happens? This is an incredible scene in your book.
Yeah. When Albert Fish was with his wife, he had begun, you know, starting some of his S&M fantasies. She wasn't really into them that much. So that's when he began putting ads in newspapers to try and get other women to participate in his fantasies, whether it was whipping him or him whipping them. The wife knew what his proclivities were. She knew, and she wasn't into it. It wasn't her thing. So, you know, that's how he, you know, kind of began, and he may have been doing some of these, you know, S&M fantasies with other people at that time. And, you know, he started late in life. You know, many serial killers, you know, by the time they're, you know, anywhere between, you know, I've known some young as, 14 to, you know, 18 or in the early 20s, they're committing these serial killings. But, you know, Fish really didn't start, you know, actual killings until, you know, probably his 40s and 50s, you know, which is unusual. That's another thing that's unusual about Albert Fish. So since his wife wasn't into these things, you know, Albert Fish goes to the attic. He was led there by the dog, and he finds another man up in the attic. And this is the man that his wife has been cheating with him on, and she had him in the attic of the house. And Albert Fish, you know, kind of meekly didn't even, you know, do much about it, you know. And in the end, what happened is his wife, Albert Fish went with the children and took them to a movie, and he came back. He came back home, and everything in the entire apartment was gone. Everything. The wife was gone. Furniture was gone. Clothing was gone. I think he said there was only like a penny in the bathtub, or not even that. He said it was entirely empty. You know, so his wife was sick of everything he was doing. You know, she couldn't deal with it anymore, and she just up and left and ran away with this other man. And that's, Albert Fish attributes that incident of his wife leaving him and the trauma that he experienced to what he said, you know, his world opened at that point. He was free to do whatever he wanted, which means, you know, even move further towards his even more sadistic fantasies, and not just these S&M play, but, you know, moving into murdering and raping young children.
Now, let's consider many of the stories that True Murder listeners will listen to, that there is no bounds to what a killer will do with his own children if he's interested in children. However, you talk about Albert Fish after this, the most traumatic event psychiatrically or psychologically in his life. What was the, how did he deal with being a father and with no mother? What was he really like in that regard to those children? And again, as a result, you see this, one of the daughters testifying at his trial, trying to save his life. So, tell us what kind of father he was.
His children testified that he was a father and a mother to them, that he took care of them, he provided for them, never abused them, never struck them, never raised a hand against them, and never uttered, you know, a foul language at all. But, you know, again, that plays in with the duality of a serial killer. Now, see, Albert Fish most likely was not on, you know, the genius scale, say, as H.H. Holmes was. But Albert Fish was a serial killer who was very sneaky and conniving. He was a little bit more of a con man. So I'm sure he was intelligent enough to understand that if he were to do anything to his children, even if he wanted to, it would all be over. You know, he'd be discovered, and he wanted to continue doing what he was doing. So, you know, these serial killers aren't just, you know, monsters with, you know, green flesh and horns on the head, or just mumbling, you know, fools. They're, you know, many of them are, you know, obviously intelligent enough to, you know, be a con man. And Albert Fish, you know, and especially when he met the greats, the Budge family, that's where he brought all his con skills, you know, came to a head. So, you know, he didn't harm his child and any of his children, and he raised them well. You know, I mean, they saw strange things. They would say sometimes they'd, you know, he'd want them to play horsey with him and jump on his back and hit him hard in his behind like he was a horse, you know, and there's a little of that stuff too. You know, and his son did say he saw him beating himself with that board, with the nail-studded board, but didn't do anything about it. But, you know, you're talking about, you know, what, early 1900s, psychiatry's in its infancy. They probably didn't even know where to go. You know, and there was a point, as you mentioned, that Albert Fish was writing these fake checks and he was writing these nasty letters and, you know, he was arrested and he did have some psychiatric, you know, help like at Bellevue and some other places, but he was always released, you know, because again, I think his conning nature, he knew what to tell these psychiatrists. Again, maybe not a genius level, but definitely a con man level.
Yeah, it's interesting too that it seems by reports that just by the virtue of, again, like you say, the age, and just the way he looked, that he looked like an innocent,
yes,
old, harmless man. So
that's the thing, too. You know, yeah, and you know, he was, you know, apprehended, you know, when, you know, he was in his late 50s, early 60s. So he looked like he was about 10 or 20 years older. So if you saw Albert Fish standing on the corner, you'd want to help this kind old man across the street. That's what he looked like, basically. And that's what the Budd family thought, that he wouldn't be able to harm a fly.
Before we talk about the Budd family, and I want you to segue into that, what he did was, his method of operation was that they would move constantly because there were reports by these children eventually. He worked as a painter, and then he had access to people for, again, a more innocent time. People were less suspicious, mm-hmm, obviously. And he had this certain look, and of course he had six children. And also, that's what he told the Budd family, too. Listen, I'm a single dad. Again, would seem admirable. I have six children. And then that story. So he did move around to not arouse suspicion. And when the heat was on, he moved around out of the area again. Tell us about the circumstances of him meeting the Budd family, the girl, Grace. And tell us about originally what the plan was and how it came to be that Albert Fish met the Budd family.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about, 1928, New York Depression era, you know, times were tough, overpopulation was rampant. So Albert Fish knew this. So hoping to find a victim, he placed an ad in the newspaper. In the old days, what would people do? They didn't have Craigslist or, you know, any of these other, you know, computer platforms to place ads on. So they would place an ad in the newspaper. So he did, and I actually found that ad, and it's in my film. And, you know, it was just, you know, he created a whole fake story, of course. You know, said he was an elderly man, and he owned a farm, and he's got money, and he needs, you know, a young man to come out to his farm and help him with things, and he'll gladly pay this young man. So the Budd family was somewhat destitute, poor family. You know, they had, I believe it was three or four children. So the Budd family basically responded to this ad because Grace's brother, you know, was kind of this large, strapping, you know, young man, especially for his age, he was kind of large. Well, when Albert Fish arrived at the house, or their apartment, actually, their little tenement apartment, he saw the brother and realized that he could be overtaken by this kid. There's no way that, you know, there's a limit that, you know, Albert Fish could, you know, strangle children. But, you know, this was a big boy that he wouldn't be able to take, you know, basically advantage of. So while he's there, he realizes that, but he makes small talk with the Budds. He flashes cash. He made sure to bring cash to flash so he could seem as if he was rich and owned this farm, which he didn't. So he basically conned them. But then you know what he said? He said, you know what? I'm going to go. I'll come back another day and we could, you know, finish the talks and secure the deal. Because at that time, again, he saw this young boy. But while he was there at the first visit, he saw their daughter, Grace Budd, who was 10 years old. Now, Grace Budd had a short bob haircut. She kind of looked like a little boy. And so Fish became enamored by her. You know, she sat on his lap, and And again, he just looked like this kind grandfather that no one would suspect would do anything or even be able to do anything if he had an opportunity to. So on the second visit, when Albert Fish came back, he had this all planned out. He said, well, you know what? I'm still going to take your son to my farm, but why don't I take your daughter, Grace? Because my granddaughter is having a birthday party for the kids, and it's going to be great. And he told her it was at a certain intersection. And shockingly, the family let this stranger take their daughter away from them. Now, people always ask me, why? Why would he do? Why would that family let him do this? You know, why would they allow the girl to go? I think it was desperation because they knew eventually, let this happen. He's got money. He's going to take care of us later. That's how desperate the times were. People don't realize now when we have everything from cell phones to video games to cars, you know, how bad it really was in early America and how difficult it was to survive. But that's why I think they allowed the daughter to go. There was a little rapport, you know, with this man. But then guess what? They leave and she doesn't come back. And then they look up the street address that Albert Fish gave them, and it didn't even exist. The intersection didn't exist. So that was pretty much it. And then after that, there was even a fake trial for another man named Pope, where the mother, Delia Budd, you know, said as a witness statement, you know, saw him in a lineup and said, that's the man, but it was a wrong man. And that's why you can't rely 100% on witnesses either. So they had this whole trial only in the end to realize this wasn't Albert Fish, the man who took her daughter. So they still can't find the daughter. But there was tried and true detective work in this case. And that's what I love and fascinates me also about these early cases, such as the detective in the Holmes story and this detective, Detective King, that he was trying to find, you know, this little girl for years and years. So his idea came about knowing that, you know, this killer would place ads in the newspapers. He said, well, you know, let's, and this was about 6 years later, 4 or 6 years later after her abduction, they still never found her. So Detective King said, well, let's put an ad in the newspaper, and Walter Winchell, who was a gossip columnist, you know, in the newspaper, so maybe this killer will read it, will mention something about Grace Budd again, you know. So Albert Fish did read this. So what he did was he was compelled to write a letter and send it to Grace Budd's mother, Delia, describing in detail of when he came to the apartment, how he took their daughter, where he took her, not in specific detail, but they took her out to the country, and that he basically strangled her and took her home and cannibalized her. And he told in detail how he made a stew and baked parts of her body. And this is a letter to her mother.
Yeah.
So, interestingly enough, here's the tried and true detective work. The envelope that the letter was sent in, there was, you know, a location, a return address on the envelope. So after tracing that letterhead back, they found out that someone was staying in this boarding house that had access to the actual envelopes. And they went and they saw some of these envelopes. And it just happened by circumstance that Detective King went to the owner of this boarding house and said, you know, there was an old man, blah, blah, blah. Do you know about this? And then the owner of the boarding house said, oh, yeah, he doesn't live here anymore. But guess what? He's going to be here in a day or two to pick up a check. So Detective King says, call me immediately when he's here. And sure enough, he gets a call that Albert Fish is there. He walks in and sees this kind little old man sipping tea like nothing happened.
Yeah.
And he apprehends him. You know, there's some different stories about Albert Fish put up a struggle or tried to kill himself at that point. But, you know, again, it's difficult to tell what happened. Some say Albert Fish just went, you know, along with Detective King, no problem. So, you know, this monster was caught. But then the world was really able to find out about all these horrors, you know, that this elderly cannibal inflicted, because Albert Fish tells them what he did to little Grace Budd. And they go up to what's called Wisteria. It's upstate New York. and I actually found the house that he murdered her in, still there, the actual house that he murdered Grace Budd in. So he told them to go there, and the detectives went, and sure enough, in an outhouse, he found the skull of Grace Budd, and there were some body parts, and, you know, they realized that he was telling the true story, even though they didn't have any evidence on any other children that you know, he raped and or murdered. They knew there were probably many others. Who knows? Dozens, hundreds, because of all his travels, we'll never know. But we do know he murdered Grace Budd, and that's what he was put on trial for and ultimately, you know, executed.
Let's talk about the media response. You talk about, and this is not the first book that chronicles the sensationalistic media that occurred for the last 67, well, it's all, probably always occurred, really. I don't know when it was so ethical, we'll say. But let's put it this way, that there was much more sensation in the publications. What was the media response? How far did it reach with this story in 1935 or after the arrest in 1934, December?
Yeah, the New York Daily News, you know, they're still somewhat kind of sensationalistic like they were at that time period. But the New York Daily News, they covered it every day, and they even paid Fish himself for his own, you know, autobiography / confession that I, you know, added to the book as well. But, man, every day it was, you know, a cover of werewolves. They called him a werewolf of Wisteria because he drank blood, and, you know, the cannibal of New York, and, you know, all these names. I mean, it was just, and of course, you know, focusing on all the lurid details, like, you know, in the courtroom when, you know, the children of the Buds met the children of Fish, you know, and how they embraced each other and cried, and, you know, because, you know, we don't realize that, yes, we know that families of the victims suffer, but, you know, the families of the murderers suffer too, because, you know, they're finding out that their loved one is now a serial killer. And there is even a wider net that it casts. Recently, I interviewed Barry Buscelli for my TV show, Serial Killer Culture TV, and he was John Wayne Gacy's childhood friend. And I had him on camera crying, saying that he has PTSD, that why wasn't there anything he could have seen when, you know, they were friends, and he has to live with this fact. So it affects many people, you know, and it was definitely a whole media sensation, you know, the fact that, you know, he was into S&M, and they found these vile letters that he would write to women, plus they found, you know, everyone was outraged that he was in the system, and he was released, you know, at least two or three times in mental hospitals and was released. Why did that happen? You know, these things still go on today, of course, but imagine back then how easy it was.
You talk about, too, and this is not unusual as well, is that these incredible serial killers are also affected by other people that they found very, very interesting and fascinating. So you talked about when he was arrested for the Budd murder, they found photos of a man named Harman from Germany. Tell us a little bit about what this Harman from Germany, Hanover, Germany, what his interests were and how that certainly seemed to affect Fish.
Yeah, Fish was obsessed with Fritz Harman, who was another cannibal. So when Fish read about Fritz Harman, that most likely just added more to his fantasies of cannibalism and the desire to find out what it would taste to feel like to taste the flesh of a child. Was it really sweet? Was their ass really the sweetest part of the body? He wanted to do it, and he acted upon that. So Fritz Harman in Germany at that time, which was a difficult time as well, would murder young boys, take pieces of their flesh and cannibalize himself, but he would also sell pieces of their flesh at the market, you know, as just meat. You know, and that's how difficult the times were at that, you know, period. When I went through one of the most shocking things I discovered, when I went through all of Wortham's file, there was a letter where Wortham wrote to someone else and saying, Fish was fascinated by this character, H.H. Holmes. I had no idea. You don't hear that ever in any other writing. I've never heard that. But it was just, to me, having done a film on Holmes, you know, but again, you know, you see some of these serial killers have a fascination and want to be like some of their predecessors. BTK, H.H. Holmes was a hero to BTK. He wanted to be like him, and, you know, and that's why I was part of that investigation into BTK. They subpoenaed my records of everyone in Wichita that bought my H.H. Holmes DVD, thinking that the BTK killer might have bought one. And, it's fascinating. But then there are some of these serial killers that probably live their day-to-day life and don't know about this whole history of serial killers, that it's just, you know, an urge that they have to, a compelling urge they have to satisfy.
Well, there may be some, but I don't think they always admit that they're influenced. I think they want to be an original. It's like musicians.
Oh, yeah.
You know, their influences are on their sleeves, but they're not going to give that away in
right.
interviews. They're not going to say right off the
hop,
oh, by the way, you know, I nick this and I nick that.
That's true.
So everybody wants to be an original. So I think certainly you can see that, yet again, it's hard to outdo H.H. Holmes and Albert Fish, but it seems like other people are at least doing it in other ways with numbers rather than maybe.
Yes. And, you know, the further you go back, you know, after Jack the Ripper and then, you know, moving forward in time, you could see how each serial killer tried to one-up the other. You know, Holmes confessed to whatever, 26 in the end, but then retracted. Then Panzram said it was 21, you know. So around that time period, you know, a couple dozen was about the standard for you to gloat about, whether you killed one or none or, you know, 10. Or 100, you know, they would say a couple dozen. But as you can see, you know, as we move forward in time, especially with like Henry Lucas and some others, it's hundreds now, you know.
Yeah.
Whether or not we can prove it, you know.
Let's talk about Dr. Wordham, because really this is the reason why we have all this information is because of this. So let's talk about the fascinating interviews he does with him, the assessments he does for court, and what he finds and what he writes later. Because, as you say, there's a book published that he does, A Show of Violence, in 1949, Doubleday. So this is a pretty big release at that time. And this trial was 1935. So let's talk about Dr. Wordham and his examinations of Albert Fish and what Albert Fish said to him. You talk about in this book, Six Confessions. And some of these details are, well, there's no more graphic detail than this. So tell us about those examinations.
Yeah. Oh, man, they were extremely graphic. But, you know, what Dr. Wortham did at that time period was really groundbreaking. You know, you look at his study, the study of Peter Curtin in 1930 in Germany. You know, these are the early, you know, the early groundwork of future, you know, forensic psychology, basically, of trying to figure out what makes these serial killers tick. You know, these were the early predecessors of the mind hunters, you know, which came about in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, he had many conversations with Albert Fish, and if it wasn't for Dr. Wortham, we may not have known all of these details, you know, because he did publish a chapter in The Masks Have No Ears, where, you know, that's like the most thorough and in-depth, you know, description of what Fish had told Wortham and reasons how and why what he did, you know, which were very important, you know. And, you know, it's fascinating that we have that record. One of the things that, you know, struck me as amazing is at that time period, you know, they call them perversions, you know, these mental disorders. So Dr. Wortham admitted that they actually had to create new perversions for Albert Fish, because that's, you know, I think it was over a dozen, like 13 or 14, that when you read my book, there's the list of perversions at the beginning of the book. And that basically shows you he did everything, drank urine, ate feces, drank blood, you know, S&M, I mean, anything imaginable you could think of, he did it. So they had to create some of those that weren't on the books at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And the biggest thing
about
is, you know, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The whole myth of the electric chair shorting out, which people still want to believe, because it is a cool myth. You know, it's this urban legend that, you know, one newspaper may have reported that, and I was never able to find out which newspaper reported it, but it was said that one newspaper reported that Albert Fish shorted out the electric chair on the first attempt because he had all these needles in his body. Well, it's just not true. You know, I found the book of the Sing Sing executioner who pulled the switch, who wrote in his book, nothing unusual happened. It was over in a matter of minutes. You know, I interviewed an expert at the University of Wisconsin electrical department that would say, you know, the needles wouldn't have done anything. But yet people still want to believe it. They still post these things on the internet. And then anytime I try to tell them the truth, they don't believe me. They don't want to hear the truth because it's such an interesting urban myth. So I just leave it be.
You talk about that Dr. Werdum basically recognizes and determines and concludes that this is Grace Budd is not the only murder and cannibalistic event that he has participated in. And you also talk about in your book that they think that he's attacked at least 100 children, and he was convinced that there was more than that. There certainly was more than Grace Budd killed. Tell us more about Dr. Werdum's conclusions, and then tell us again, which is really he was hired by the defense. So tell us how, in his estimation, why in his estimation that he's legally insane. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we'll never know, you know, and that's why I'm glad I found some more of these confessions in the files that were sealed till 2010, because, you know, we had heard some of the Fish's confessions, but there are even more in here that I had never heard about prior to seeing these, you know, documents that were released after 2010. You know, and Dr. Werdum said it was apparent, you know, that Albert Fish was insane, you know, but between the voices that he heard, the visions that he had, you know, which were both religious, texture, to the fact of all these perversions that he did, that he has to be insane. Sure, he could function on a day-to-day basis, but Dr. Werdum said he was insane, you know, and he was found guilty and sentenced to be executed basically for revenge, you know, and that's a problem our society still has, that, you know, society wants, a pound of flesh, you know, as revenge, and that's what we did with Albert Fish. We executed him when we should have put him in an insane asylum. And, you know, the one interesting quote is from Fish's attorney, James Dempsey, where he said, this, you know, ruling proves that, you know, witches are still burned in America. Basically that he was a target and he was found to be sane just so he could be executed for revenge of society for what he did to this little girl. And I mean, I understand the outrage, you know, I mean, I understand that, but on the other side of the coin, I think there might be something to learn from these people. And I feel as a society, how can we advance if we don't study them to try and figure out why they're doing these things?
The sensationalistic wanting a pound of flesh media, though, what was their consensus about his sanity?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they were trying to, you know, prove the fact that he was sane by, you know, looking at the other side of the coin, by saying, well, you know, he obviously went to the Buds with this intention of kidnapping your daughter. It was pre-planned. It was pre-motivated. You know, so, you know, that's always this question of, sanity versus insanity, intent versus, you know, is it just a crime of passion? Did a husband find out his wife's cheating and he hits her over the head and murders her? That's something different. So, you know, when it gets, you know, into all these legalities, that's where it gets, you know, pretty complicated. And they, you know, the newspapers, I believe, were trying to prove that point that, you know, these were premeditated murders. And even though he had all these different S&M fantasies and proclivities, he was still, you know, of a set mind, of right mind, that he, you know, could get up, He could hold himself. He could eat. He knew what he was doing. He made these decisions consciously, and he should be executed. So there's always those two sides of the coin, and we still deal with that today. You know, that with Dahmer, you know, could he have been put in an insane hospital or a prison? You know, that's the thing. And interestingly enough, he's put in the prison where he's murdered. So
the thing is, though, I understand what if they, you set the standard at whether the defendant knows the difference between right and wrong, then it's a high standard to overcome.
Yes.
It's hard to, you know, hard to disprove that, to say, well, or to prove, he did know right from wrong, when you see premeditation, you see planning, deliberation, and then trying to conceal their whereabouts and other such things. So that's the standard, because they do fear that it's a slippery slope, that everybody can be considered, because, you know, it's very interesting, at this time in 1935, that's what I find fascinating, is that despite the family saying, look at this guy, was normal, he was a good father, and then he had this very, very traumatic event with the mother leaving, taking all the furniture, moving out with the boarder, leaving the young children destitute, that this certainly would have been taken into consideration, a mitigating factor, you know. But what they were also doing is that what I found fascinating is Dr. Werdum, even though he had Fish's own confessions of prior murderous behavior. He talked about one time where he would have killed the child, but there was too many cars going by, so he really didn't get an opportunity. With Dr. Werdum's conclusion that he certainly killed more people than Grace Budd, and he certainly, it was easy for him to conclude that there were maybe 100 children attacked, and yet he still was in his book, in his writings, in his defense, on the stand, adamant that he was legally insane. I find that very, very interesting. And also that he was saying that, again, 25%, he said, of the population was psychopathic in his mind, which I thought, that blew my mind that somebody would be talking about that in 1935. That sounds like a pretty new concept.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think he was definitely a forward thinker. You know, but again, you know, we're talking about those infancies, too, of the right and wrong and, you know, the serial killers, the infancies of serial killers. You know, really the world, of course, serial killers existed before Jack the Ripper, but the world was introduced to them through the mass media of newspapers and then television. So, you know, we didn't even know what these types of people were as a society. You know, we had seen them probably in war and, you know, on the frontier and things like that, but becoming a civilized society and then seeing there were these some people that could murder over and over again, I think people didn't know what to make of it. And these were the inceptions, the beginnings of the psychology and you know, the law enforcement aspect and the legalities of dealing with these type of people. It's, you know, it's fascinating. That's why I enjoy these early cases, because every angle you look at them, historical, forensic, psychology, it's just fascinating, and a lot of these early criminals got away with it for much longer, you know, than, you know, some of our modern ones, because, of course, you know, video cameras, lack of DNA and forensics and, you know, even fingerprinting, you know, was in its infancy.
It's interesting, too, when he talks about that part of his time on the stand, he said, listen, I just previously, 2 months of this, made out 160 commitment papers for more than 160 patients without any court hearing, he said. And he said, many of them, he said, not as sick as Albert Fish and none of them as dangerous. Just to demonstrate, he said, that Albert Fish somehow had slipped through the net. Again, I'm surprised that there was that, he thought there was that much of a safety net in psychiatry and in hospitals at that time.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing too, you know, Albert Fish's cunning nature was obvious in that he could fool these psychiatrists to release him, obviously, you know, because he knew what to say. So I think, you know, his cunning nature should have probably alone overridden the fact. I mean, plus he could tell right and wrong, but that should have overridden the fact that he had these S&M fantasies and, you know, these other things that he was doing. You know, and he may have used, but, you know, and that's the thing, too, in the end. We never know if these people are telling the truth. you know, when he was arrested, he could have made up the fact that he saw, you know, Jesus coming to him and he heard these things. You know, we don't know. You know, we don't know. It's they're very fascinating stories and, you know, early glimpses into the mind of serial killers. You know, and of course, Frederick Wortham went on to be hated by comic book lovers because he went on a whole tirade against the Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt comic books, saying these are diseasing the mind of our children and corrupting them. And, you know, he caused those comic books basically to fold. So he became the poster boy. He eventually later, he did apologize before his death, but people still, you know, have a lot of distaste for him. But, you know, and that's another thing too, you know, we even go through that now with these shooters and saying, well, they're still doing it. Ah, it's these violent video games, these violent movies. But, you know, studying Jesse Pomeroy, who is the subject of my next film, you know, in 1874, he was 14 when he murdered two little children. So what are you going to blame it on in 1874? You can't blame it on radio, TV, movies, video games, but they blamed it on the dime novels. There's always got to be something, those violent dime novels. You know, so again, I think we got to start blaming and looking at studying these people.
You talk about Dr. Wortham, too, saying that when he was asked how many children he thought Albert Fish killed, he said, well, he said at least five. He said one of the detectives said eight at least. And a judge of the Supreme Court who had been present when Dr. Wortham testified said he had been informed that Fish was implicated in 15 child murders.
Yes.
What do you think?
And yeah, so like H.H. Holmes will never know. With Fish, I think it could have easily been several dozen children. Easily, minimum. But we'll never know. We do know the Billy Gaffney story. The story of, you know, these two children. One of them was Billy Gaffney, and I filmed actually inside the same tenement building that they lived. And they were on the top floor, and they were playing on the top floor. And the mother came out from the apartment, and, you know, Albert Fish was the original stranger danger. There wasn't that type of thing in the 1920s and early New York. You know, these kids would play on the street, parents would be in their house, or who knows where. The kids would just be doing their own thing. I mean, these were little children, you know. So the mother comes out of the apartment and sees one of the kids, her child, but not the other one, says, well, where's Billy Gaffney? And then the little boy pointed up to the fire escape leading to the roof and said, the boogeyman took him. So Albert Fish was really the original boogeyman as well. And I was in that tenement apartment hallway and saw that fire escape. It's in my film that he took him out of. Now, again, we can't prove that, but Albert Fish says that he took the boy and he took him to a secluded place by the Riker's dump and started cutting parts of his body off and, you know, all these things. So, you know, just looking at that and the murder of and cannibalism of Grace Budd, you could see how much more he could have done. And I would say minimum dozens. We'll just never know.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about the family was there. What do we have? Five of Fish's children, two daughters and three sons. Mm-hmm. There are also a few other people were also present. And the defense pleaded for commutation of the death sentence and confinement to a state institution for the criminally insane. But it's fascinating that all of those children, again, it doesn't always happen, were supportive regardless of the world thinking that their father was a monster. They didn't back away from supporting him and at that trial, did they?
No, no. And it's interesting, too, you know, sometimes families will turn their back. They may change their names. They may move away because they don't want to be associated with it. They don't want the bad press coverage. They just don't want to deal with it. Or you have some that will live in denial, too. I mean, you know, whether or not Fish's children actually admitted and felt he did those things was one thing. You know, but you take the case of the guy that was in Indiana, yeah, the Fox Hollow Farm, I always forget his name, Herb Baumeister. Now, you know, Herb Baumeister, I think it was in the 70s or 80s, he was married and had children, and then he had a home called Fox Hollow in the country in Indiana, and he would go to gay bars, pick up young gay men, take them back to Fox Hollow and strangle them, murder them, and wind up throwing, you know, their body parts, you know, in the woods behind it. And eventually that led to his apprehension because his children went out there and found these skulls and bones. And that's when the police were called. And, you know, he took off and he ultimately, you know, committed suicide. So they never really found out exactly what happened. But to this day, his wife and children still say, he didn't do those things. Not my husband, not our father. There's no way. Even though there were all the evidence was there, the skulls, the bones. So it's very interesting, you know, I mean, and that's one thing too, you know, you know, how far does your love go? And you see in many of these cases too that, you know, the parents or siblings, you know, they will stand by their side. I mean, that happened with Jesse Pomeroy too. His mother was there and she tried to get him, you know, released or, you know, released from solitary at least. And she wrote letters and did whatever she could. It was probably her fault that he murdered the two little children because she pleaded with the reform school to let him out early. They did. And of course, at that time, they didn't alert the authorities that he was released. So then he murdered two little children because the authorities thought he was still in reform school.
Yeah, well. You know. I wanted to mention, too, before we go, is that I wanted to tell the audience, too, that you have – I love black and white photos, and you have some amazing black and white photos in here in your book and incredible source documents. Again, we talked about that at the beginning, how important that is, and I think that is important that you can people can see the actual document. These are source documents and letters, Albert Fish, his handwriting – and again, amazing black and white photos of everything, including even the electric chair. It is very, very a great addition. So I want to thank you very much for that. I also want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Albert Fish in his own words. We talked. I mentioned that you're a filmmaker and you did talk about a couple films and other true crime books, and you deal with just the most serious of these serial killers with your films and with your books. For those people that might want to take a look at your other work, do you have a website, Facebook page? How can they take a look at some of the other stuff we just hinted at today?
Yeah, I'm pretty much all over the internet. My webpage is just my name, my website, johnborowski.com. But if you even go to, say, Amazon Prime, all of my work is on there as far as film and TV shows. So there's H.H. Holmes, Albert Fish, Carl Panzram, Serial Killer Culture, which examines the contemporary culture of collectors and museums and artists and musicians fascinated by serial killers and why they are. And then I took that concept and created a TV show, which is on Amazon Prime, Serial Killer Culture TV, which is episodic. So each episode, the second season's coming out hopefully in a couple weeks. I'm still working with Amazon to get that up. But then it'll be 12 episodes. You know, each episode's focus is on, you know, like one is Gacy's brain, another one is Peter Curtin's head at the Ripley's Museum in Wisconsin. So all fascinating topics. And then my books are on Amazon as well. The Albert Fish, Ed Gein, Dahmer's Confession, and The Strange Case of H.H. Holmes.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Very nice to speak with you. Thank you very much, John Borowski, for this interview, and congratulations on this amazing book, Albert Fish in His Own Words. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
Thank you for having me on. Take care.
Good night.